title Pontifex Maximus literally translates to greatest bridge builder. For centuries, it belonged exclusively to the pagan emperors of ancient Rome, starting with Augustus, denoting their status as the chief high priest of the Roman state religion. Yet today, if you look at the monuments and coins of the Vatican, you will see that exact same Latin title inscribed next to the name of the Pope. The ultimate symbol of pagan Roman authority was seamlessly absorbed by the very religion that Rome once tried to annihilate.
That migration of a single title captures a massive historical collision. We're looking at the exact moment where faith collides with empire. The marginalized, persecuted communities of early Christians were suddenly elevated to the halls of imperial power. And in that process, the boundaries between the original teachings of Jesus and the entrenched cultural machinery of Rome became permanently blurred.
This brings us directly to a fascinating piece of writing by the restaurateur Ninox Antelihau, titled When Power Meets Belief. Antelihau poses a profound question about this exact historical pivot. He asks, when a powerful system adopts a belief, does it preserve it or does it reshape it? He argues that early Christianity did not exist in a vacuum. Once it was institutionalized by the Roman Empire, it was standardized, and it blended with the centuries of Greek, Roman, and Germanic traditions that already existed.
Antelihau's premise is crucial because it forces us to discard the simplistic narrative of early Christian history. The conventional story treats the rise of Christianity as a sudden, clean break from the pagan past. The historical reality is far messier. When Emperor Constantine issued the Edict of Milan in 313 AD, decriminalizing Christian worship, he did not erase Roman culture. He merged them. For years after his supposed conversion, Constantine continued to mint coins featuring Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, the official sun god of the later Roman Empire.
I want to push back on the timeline there. Constantine is often portrayed as the first Christian emperor who flipped the switch for the entire empire. But if he is still minting coins with the sun god, how much of his conversion was a genuine theological shift, and how much was a pragmatic political strategy to unify a fracturing empire?
Historians debate that exact point endlessly. Constantine likely viewed the Christian god and the solar deity through a syncretic lens, where different gods were seen as manifestations of a single divine principle. To the average Roman citizen, the transition was not a sudden theological revolution. It was a gradual blending. Antelihau uses a brilliant analogy in his essay. He compares this process to a new software update running on old hardware. The core message changed, but the dates, the symbols, and the rituals, the hardware, remained heavily influenced by the pagan environment.
Let us examine that hardware specifically, starting with the calendar. Antelihau points out that the Bible provides no specific date for the birth of Jesus, yet we celebrate it on December 25th. That date was not chosen at random, was it?
Not at all. In the 3rd century, the Roman Empire celebrated the rebirth of the unconquered sun, or Sol Invictus, on December 25th, which coincided with the winter solstice. It was a period of feasting and gift-giving following the Saturnalia festival. The church in Rome began formally celebrating Christmas on December 25th in 336 AD during Constantine's reign. As Antelihau notes, it was easier to celebrate the Son of God when the populace was already accustomed to celebrating the Son of Rome.
But is that a hostile takeover of a holiday or a natural cultural synthesis? Some scholars argue that early Christians were not cynically stealing pagan dates to trick people into converting, but rather they were participating in the cultural rhythms of their time, giving existing celebrations new theological meaning.
It is a mix of both. You cannot separate the religious from the socio-political in late antiquity. The adoption of December 25th served a dual purpose. It provided Christians with a counter-narrative to the prevailing pagan festivals, while simultaneously making the new state religion more palatable to the masses. We see a similar phenomenon with Easter. The Venerable Bede, an 8th-century English monk and historian, recorded that the Anglo-Saxon month Easter month was named after a pagan goddess of the dawn and spring named Ostre. Feasts were held in her honor during the time we now associate with the paschal season.
So the very name of the most important Christian holiday in the English language derives from a Germanic pagan deity.
Anta Lihau points out that ancient symbols of fertility and new life, like eggs and hares, were eventually linked to the resurrection. The pagan focus on cyclical nature was reframed into a linear historical narrative about Jesus.
Precisely. The focus shifted from the cycles of the harvest to a singular event of salvation. But the persistence of the pagan hardware demonstrates that belief does not exist in isolation. Ideas move through language and power. When the Roman Empire institutionalized Christianity, it did not just passively adopt the faith, it engineered it. It defined what was orthodox and what was heretical.
That engineering requires a mechanism of control. Anta Lihau argues that once the belief became part of an organized system, certain writings were accepted, while others were rejected, lost, or actively suppressed. How did the church, now backed by imperial and later papal authority, manage the massive influx of diverse interpretations and texts?
They built a bureaucracy of censorship. The most striking example is the Index Librorum Prohibitorum, or the Index of Forbidden Books. It was first published in 1559 by the Sacred Congregation of the Roman Inquisition to combat the spread of Protestant writings. Following the Council of Trent, a revised Tridentine Index was issued in 1564, establishing strict rules for the preemptive censorship of texts.
This was not just a gentle list of recommendations. The index was enforced by Catholic states and carried the threat of excommunication. It banned translations of the Bible into vulgar tongues and prohibited the works of major philosophers and astronomers. Johannes Kepler's works on Copernican astronomy were placed on the index, as were the writings of Immanuel Kant, Thomas Hobbes, and David Hume. The church utilized this legal framework to maintain doctrinal purity by physically destroying heretical books and forcing printers to flee to places like Switzerland. The index was an active instrument of control from 1560 all the way until it was abolished in 1966.
That is a staggering timeline. Up until 1966, an organized effort to control literature remained in place. This underscores Anta Lihau's central thesis. What we have today is not the full, unvarnished picture of early Christian thought, but rather a curated selection of what was permitted to survive by those in power. We're looking at a heavily edited manuscript of history.
And the editing process often involved co-opting the tools of the old empire. Going back to the title of Pontifex Maximus, the greatest bridge builder, in the ancient Roman religion, the Pontifex Maximus was the chief high priest who oversaw public worship and the calendar. When Rome adopted Christianity, the Christian emperors eventually dropped the title, and it was later adopted by the Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
It is a profound irony. The religious head of the Roman Catholic Church operates from Vatican City, bearing the title of the ancient pagan priests who would have overseen the rituals that early Christians refused to participate in, sometimes at the cost of their lives. Does this systemic co-opting invalidate the core of the belief?
Anta Lihau argues that it does not. History is rarely a clean binary between absolute truth and absolute fabrication. He states that ideas can begin genuinely, spread through people, and later be structured and influenced by power. The fact that the church adopted the administrative structures of the Roman Empire, or that Christmas aligns with Sol Invictus, does not automatically make the original teachings of Jesus false. It just means the delivery system was adapted for survival and dominance.
But it does create a profound tension. For the modern believer or historian, if the hardware is constructed by imperial power and the software has been repeatedly updated through ecumenical councils and censorship lists, how do we isolate the original signal from the historical noise?
We might not be able to isolate it perfectly, and that is the uncomfortable reality Anta Lihau invites us to accept. He suggests that the most honest position is not dogmatic certainty, but a clear awareness of what we know and what has been lost. The syncretism of early Christianity,
the blending of Eostra and the resurrection, of Sol Invictus and the Nativity, shows that human spirituality is deeply tied to its cultural environment.
It requires us to view religious history not as a fragile glass structure that shatters if touched by pagan influence, but as a living, evolving ecosystem. The institutions of power, whether the court of Constantine or the authors of the Index Librorum Prohibitorum, acted as evolutionary pressures. They shaped the theology, decided which texts survived, and built the cathedrals, but they did not invent the initial spark of the movement.
Exactly. The initial movement consisted of scattered communities with no power, no protection, and no systemic backing. They possessed a radical message that challenged the ruling structure. The paradox is that the only way that message could survive across millennia and reach billions of people was by being absorbed and codified by the very type of imperial power it initially resisted. Intoliha's work challenges us to hold these contradictions without rushing to a simple conclusion. We can acknowledge the bureaucracy of the Counter-Reformation and the syncretism of Roman festivals while still recognizing the profound impact of the underlying philosophy. It is an invitation to examine belief honestly. If this exploration of history and power shifted your perspective, send this episode to a friend who loves digging into the origins of the ideas that shape our world.